Okay, thank you, Martin.
Douglas Goist is in the audience, and I'm going to give Doug a chance to introduce himself, both in his professional capacity here in D.C., and then also more specific to this pilot as a member of the Steering and Advisory Committee, which Aubrey referenced earlier. So, Doug, I'm going to hand it over to you for a few minutes.
Good morning. First of all, I'd like to thank Aubrey and Martin for their good work with this pilot. It's very interesting. There's some results that I wasn't aware of that would happen that I'm really kind of surprised by. But first of all, just to give you an introduction, I work for National Industries for the Blind in the United States. We are the largest employer of persons who are blind. Right now it's over 6,100 individuals. We have 90 associated agencies across the country, and they produce over 3,500 products, and we're now getting into services. We were started in 1938 under an act called the Wagner O'Day Act under the Roosevelt administration. The primary purpose and our mission statement is to provide employment opportunities and personal independence for persons who are blind. As you can imagine, in 1938, that technology wasn't around, so most of the jobs would be assembling brooms, janitorial services, and so forth. It's only within the last 10, 15 years that we are now able to offer more advanced career training and so forth, thanks to technology and from what we're talking about today, mobile phone technology, screen reading technology, and so forth. My position at NIB is a assistive technology specialist, and I support over 70 individuals right now who are as part of a contract management support program. What that is they are contractors for the federal government to follow up on contracts, and all of them are legally blind and blind, and they're working at a salaried level, a good salary depending on region. So essentially, moving into the study here, what really surprised me, as I said, was the fact that over 90% or 98% of the individuals were aware of mobile financial systems and money transfers and so forth. It's a great contrast from here, I believe, that persons who are blind in the United States are aware that there are systems to access through your phone, but if you're blind in the U.S., usually you're going to have a computer connection and a screen reader, say, and do your banking that way. With very few individuals, there's very a lot of hesitation and resistance in using your mobile phone to start doing anything to do with your checking account, bank account, and so forth. Part of it is an accessibility issue, but another part is also the concerns about security. So I think this is a real area to focus on and look at. That, you know, in a lot of ways, Kenya is way ahead of the U.S. as far as doing these types of transactions. The U.S. that's probably your third option, is to use your mobile handset. The other interesting parts were the fact that the older generation, older adults, were more technology proficient, let's say, even if they couldn't use the devices to their full potential, whereas here the younger population seems to be much more involved into smartphones and using apps and so forth. A crossover was the fact that their 30% were employed or self-employed. That mirrors what's happens in the U.S. The current rate is about 68-70% of persons who are blind or unemployed or underemployed, so around 30% as well. So I was interested to see that was similar. Part of the study is going to look at, as Aubrey had mentioned, the confidentiality aspect of using these phones. I, as an individual who was very technically savvy before my vision loss, was only able to use a smartphone or text in 2008, and not very well, because the phone really didn't have a capacity, a full capacity. So in the intervening years, phones got better, and I was able to use those speech screen readers and audible readouts and so forth. But there's still a long way to go, and maybe one or two providers will have, or operating system developers will have, full access to their phones in the current iteration of the technology. So it'll be interesting to see how far an individual, how much confidentiality they're able to have to complete their transactions, and in what environment. In other words, are you going to have to use a headset? Are they going to have to talk to the phone providers? All of these tie together, especially with policy, discussing with the internet service provider, the phone providers and the bank officials, that, you know, even if you have a phone that's speech enabled, if you change the way you transact your money, or you change the system, the user interface, that could really impact somebody using a phone, and they would potentially be confused and so forth. So with that, I'll just turn it back over to Maria, but I appreciate, again, Martin and Aubrey's and their group's work on this, and it'll be really interesting to see the further studies as they drill down deeper into the types of phones they're using, the and some of the reasons why, that on the policy level, why things are the way they are and how they can improve. So thank you.
Thanks, Doug. Before we go to Q&A, I just wanted to mention, I'm not sure if we mentioned earlier in any of our comments, a sort of bigger context of the visually impaired within Kenya. I think it's around 567,000. That's the registered number. Right, so you can imagine it is most likely much higher than that, particularly in the urban areas. So just to put that as a context, and imagine that large number of people, for a variety of reasons, not being able to fully participate within the economic community within Kenya, and then the impact on economic growth and other variables resulting from that. Before we turn to Q&A, I just wanted to prompt a couple of the questions, mainly for Charlotte, to see if she can't mention a little bit contextually about the potential in terms of next steps for accessing universal fund sources for programming that could develop appropriate technology-based programming. And then maybe we could speak a little bit to, you know, what the potential role is for donors, the large foundations, private sector actors such as the mobile network operators, et cetera. So those are just a couple of prompts before we turn over the floor to Q&A.
Please raise your hand and speak into the microphone. When you have a question, just so the webinar audience can hear you, and we'll alternate between webinar and in-room questions.
If I may just pick up on a point that Doug raised, and he said he was surprised by the 90% of persons who were blind or visually impaired that were aware of the MFS. I mean, given that 70 to 80% of Kenyans use M-Pesa, which is this mobile system, this mobile financial platform, I guess it's not that surprising. Because even though persons with disabilities may not be using the platform, their families are using their platform, their neighbors are using their platform. There's been a very, I mean, if you drive around in Nairobi, M-Pesa is everywhere. So there's been a very kind of aggressive campaign around, you know, mobile financial banking in Kenya. And so, you know, I would imagine that's why the percentage is so high
in Kenya. Right.
Mm-hmm. It's also pretty high in Uganda, and I think that this is. And I think that this is an area where donors should be looking, you know, to Maria's point. I think this is an area that, you know, donors could start thinking about. We all talk about the importance of innovation. This, to me, is innovation at its best. It can be low cost. Its potential for inclusion is huge. So if you have an accessible handset, you can, as I said in my opening remarks, you can engage in the banking in banking, but you can also be part of a whole range of other opportunities that that mobiles are now being used for. So you know, for women with disabilities who may be pregnant, this is a perfect tool for prenatal, you know, checks and all of that. So I think that we should think about the device as a device of development, and a device that can, again, at low cost, be used by persons with disabilities.
Maybe I'll just make two observations. One is one of the things that is very interesting about the developing countries and the use of mobile technology. One of the things that the developing countries have done is, in some ways, they are, in developing countries, we are ahead of the game in the context that keyboards, within a very short period of time, would be the thing of the past. Developing countries are already onto the mobile platform. And using mobile platform for persons with disability, training persons who are blind to use the mobile platform over keyboards, is many of those persons who can use it, while the younger kids in school might be using keyboards, the older persons are using the mobile technology, and that's why you see that difference.
I think it's a cost factor.
I was just going to say it's an economic difference as well.
Yeah, because computers, keyboards cost a lot more than a smartphone. And so people have a lot more access to the smartphone than they would to a computer. So, you know, to Doug's point, where people here in the U.S. Use the computer, this is not necessarily an option in Kenya or in the rest of Africa. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's fine. Yeah, well, that's the point. I mean, the economic point is well said, both for students and the older person who can lay his or her hand on a $30 phone versus, I don't know how much a keyboard costs.
which, as I understand, is getting even cheaper with a thriving second-hand market in Android.
Right.
Absolutely,
so, yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, we have a question from someone on the webinar.
Yeah.
Hi, good morning. This question is actually a couple questions from Astrid de Germay from Oris Development in Paris. She asks specifically, what is the snowball method? And then she would like some more details and descriptions on the speech-enabled phones. Are there specific phones, specific software, or just phones that we're all used to? For example, does the Nokia that are all over Africa called speech-enabled phones?
Like, you could say what the phone is, but do you want to put a brand out to talk about it?
That's up to you.
Okay. Martin, you want to take a crack at the methodology piece?
The snowball.
That's right. Basically, what we did was, since we do not have a mapping process on where to find people, maybe using maps or any other kind of thing, we were using KUB networks so that their branches would identify the people they know are, you know, findable within the time and give us a listing of the people available. So we did not do like sampling and sampling kind of thing. So basically one person would lead us to the next person and the next person to the next person. With the assistance of the KUB, you know, organized groups in the different places.
In terms of the software, in general, in development language term, it's really a network effect, so that one person tells the other and it snowballs, or the network reaches out about the study. In terms of the software, they're at the high end. There are many phones from Android and Apple and so on that comes with built-in software. And those are the ones that, the $300 plus ones. So those come with the software that is already built in. And at the lower end, there are some phones, somewhere in the middle range rather than the lower end. It has to be a certain level of phones that come where you can buy software from two or three different companies around the world and download the software onto the phone.
Can I just say that I thought one of the interesting points that Aubrey raised in his presentation was that even the owning of phones or access to phones is gendered, and the percentage of men that had access or had phones over women who had or had access to phones was strikingly large. And I just throw that out because it's clearly it's not just about disability. It's about a whole range of marginalization and exclusion.
Economics is really good.
Economics, I guess, is at the base of it.
Yeah.
Any questions from the floor? Comments, thoughts?
My name is Charles Hess. I'm from FHI 360. I'm working on a couple mobile technology projects funded by USAID, and I was curious, with regards to this current initiative, what has been your interaction with the mobile network operators in Kenya, and what can they do to enable access for these customers that they have that they may not even realize the number?
I'm going to let Martin answer that as well, because we do have members of the mobile network. And the mobile providers on the steering committee, and we have had significant relationship with particularly Safaricom, but with some of the others as well. So Martin, you want to answer that a little bit more?
That's right. We have representatives of the two largest networks here, Safaricom and Orange, in the steering committee. And from Safaricom, we have the chair of the M-Pesa Foundation. It's a foundation established about 2 years ago to give back some of the profits that are coming out of the MSS. He was previously the chair of Safaricom Foundation, but M-Pesa Foundation was established to give large grants rolling into millions of dollars. And he's been sitting in the committee and very interested in how the foundation can roll out a program that enhances inclusivity. From Orange, we have the head of the Orange Money product, basically the one who's in charge of the MSS within Orange. And yesterday, we also gave lots of interesting options and perspectives on how the company could improve accessibility. So they're engaged, basically, and are waiting for the results.
I mean, I just might add that I think one of the attractive aspects of this pilot is that it really brings together, public-private partnerships. We've got Perkins working on it. We've got M-Pesa and Orange as part of the steering committee. And, you know, this is really something that USAID is keen to support. The public-private partnerships, and at the core of this is innovation. And again, I do want to emphasize that because, you know, I think it is through innovation that we can begin to break down some of the barriers around exclusion writ large.
If I could just make one quick comment, I was struck by one of the statistics here, namely that 19% of those interviewed use their own SIM cards, while 69% use borrowed phones and then their own SIM cards with borrowed phones. I'm just hoping that in the study we can also tease out potential issues related to broad access to the underlying identification needed to get a SIM card. Mm-hmm. And this takes us into a real deep territory in development of, who gets birth certificates necessary to get the identification and all that. So I just want us to sort of peel back the layers a little bit on that issue as well, because we could find disparities that are gender-based and rural-based on that very simple thing, and we could be making an assumption that everyone can get a SIM card, which may not necessarily be true.
Yeah. That might very well be looked at in relationship to access, especially for women, in terms of ownership. Because to get a SIM card, you have to have an address and lots of other stuff.
Well, you have to legally exist. In some countries,
you have to have an ID,
right?
Some kind of an ID.
Yeah.
And so, if you don't have an ID, then you can't access.
Right.
So, I think Maria raises a very valid point. That may then be, at the initial stage, a way of keeping people out.
Right.
I think you had a question or comment, right? No.
Oh.
All right.
Someone could buy a SIM card off the shelf and use it, but about a year ago, a regulation was issued to have all SIM cards registered, and any that were not registered were shut down. So that's made a big difference in people being able to access SIM cards. And it was discussed in yesterday's meeting, actually, as an issue, and flagged also as leading to a means of operators knowing their clients more.
Exactly.
When they register them, things around knowing that this client requires speech-enabled access and things like that.
I also thought the concept of the agent was very interesting because it has the potential to be useful, but it has the potential to be very, very can go very, very wrong. And again, I mean, for people with disabilities, this is really difficult because you're depending on somebody else. So I think that that's an interesting relationship, and it's clearly not a regulated relationship. So that, I think, would be interesting to flesh out a bit in the research to get a better sense of, who these agents are in the event that you don't get a confirmation. What do you do? What kind of recourse do you have if Agent A decides, hey, well, I'm, you're blind and this is just the perfect opportunity for me to, take this money and,
And you may have the legal recourse, but how practical is it
exactly
for you to
if you're
that
in, if you're in Tika or Quito, wherever.
And I think, Martin, you guys were discussing some of that yesterday because I raised a question around that in a slightly different way, but you were discussing the question of whether of how much control the phone companies have over the agent, and for all intents and purposes, they were saying they didn't have that control.
And I'm sure you have to pay the agent.
The agent is a shopkeeper.
So that's an additional disadvantage.
The agents are control. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead, Martin.
Go ahead.
Okay. Basically, the agents are controlled by regulations by the operators and have a level of interaction. What I think is that what is so happening is that certain kind of loose relationships exist between agents and visually impaired users, where they basically overlook some of the regulations in the name of assisting the users. And the MNOs yesterday were raising that as a serious issue they need to address within the framework of regulation of agents.
But there were a lot of issues raised about that relationship. Anyway, I think somebody on the web.
That's right. Because
I think somebody had a question from the web.
Yes, I have a question from Mesfin Fikre Woldmariam, who's joining us today from Addis Ababa University in Ethiopia. He has two questions. This first one ties a little bit into what you were just speaking about. The question is, if a visually impaired person sends money to a wrong person, how will he know his action, and is there any possibility of getting his money back? Mm-hmm. Is there any legal framework that helps get the money back?
Second question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. thank you, Aubrey. The second question is, it says, as I see from the presentation, smartphones with speech-enabled software are relatively expensive. How do you see this working for poor individuals who earn $2 a day?
They're both very, very, very important questions. The first question is which we were speaking to in terms of that relationship with the agent, if there's an error of sending money to the wrong person, etc. That's one of the regulation questions that one will have to look at as to what is the recourse, and that has to come in regulation and policy. and either with the operator or more so by national, when national governments begin to recognize and develop regulation around MFF and taking into consideration the plight of persons with disability within that framework, that's a critical piece. So that when they develop regulation and policies, they should have some references around interface and interaction with persons with disabilities as to how they interact with that, as they do in other policies like education or health and so on and so on. So that's something to be looked at, for especially those persons who are into regulation. In terms of cost of software, that's a critical question. That's a question that is not a question. I think Charlotte was talking a lot about development and innovation. That's where that has to come in. Right at this time, it's not a question that the disability community answers. It's a question that we're confronted with on a lot of fronts, working in, especially in blindness, because the market is so small, relatively speaking. What some have been able to do is where you are making it more universal, you're able to bring the price down. Mm-hmm. But how much they can do that will depend on innovation and creativity.
And I think there are some interesting examples of how communities or associations of persons with disabilities have been able to negotiate, say, good prices for phones for their members. So, for instance, in South Africa, the South Africa Council for the Blind has been able to negotiate lower prices of the actual handset with the various service providers for its members. And this is because they have great numbers and they make the case for the number of people they're bringing in, but they also make the case for using the phone as a tool for protection, a tool for communication, and for all the things that the mobile phone can be used for. So I think, again, it's about looking at all the various options out there to ensure that there is better access for persons with disabilities, because given the current costs, it makes it very exclusive for most persons with disabilities.
My name is Mike Catalano. I'm with PMT Americas, which is a relationship with a South African mobile transactions and mobile money vendor. The observation that Maria made about the percentage, I think that was for people that did not own phones, the borrowing of a SIM.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In South Africa, it's RICA is the regulation to register for a SIM, to get a SIM card, you need to provide a valid address, mm-hmm. Or national ID or foreign ID,
mm-hmm.
To get your SIM card. I think very similar regulations exist in many mm-hmm. other countries in Africa. But that really alludes to the opportunity for access across devices. So we see here in the States, somebody had mentioned that internet banking is the predominant way that somebody that's visually impaired will access their financial services. And I think what we're going to see is not necessarily just a single device for access, but it's going to be a tablet or a connected mobile device. And one other point on the hardware and software costs relating to speech-enabled phones is that there's two levels of cost. One is the hardware itself and the embedded software that resides on the phone. And the other one is that these higher-end phones that we're familiar with here, like Android, that requires network access to
right.
run some of that speech recognition software. So for a price-sensitive consumer or somebody that's poor in emerging markets, they'll not only need the hardware and the software on the device, they might need to have access to a data plan. So there might be an opportunity to look at subsidization of the cost of the data service if that's going to be a mm-hmm. network-enabled speech mm-hmm. Capability. And lastly, I think this was a wide net cast for looking for respondents for the survey, and I think there may be opportunities not only within USAID programs but other bilateral donor programs where we can even get more granular on certain types of visual impairment with mm-hmm. certain types of employment. For example, smallholders or somebody in the family of a smallholder that
yeah.
mm-hmm. might be the economic person within the household.
Right.
Malawi, I'm thinking in particular, and opportunities in South Africa as well.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Thank you.
You had a question, did you?
Yes, I did. Hi, thanks so much. I'm Chelsea from the Mobile Health Alliance at the United Nations Foundation. And I just had a quick question about caregivers and if there was any look in the study toward the caregivers of particularly elderly persons with disabilities and their use of mobile phones and their use of mobile phones with their patients.
I'm going to pass it to Martin, but simply say that we didn't look at the caregivers because the focus was on the person itself. So, but I'll let Martin build on that.
That's right. What came out of the research and later from the focus group dealing with the lower end users is that people seem to depend more on the agent than the family relation when it comes to MSF. And what they will do is to carry their phone and money and whatever identification to the agent and instruct the agent on whatever transaction they wish to be conducted. And once that is done, they go back home with their phone. So that's basically the trend that we seem to see from most of the regions.
So from the poorer group, they depended on family to assist in the process one way or the other, taking it, taking the message, if you might. But we didn't look at that actual, more to your point, the caregiver, because we are looking at persons. We looked at a cross-section of people, some people are workers, people who are students, people who are not so much dependent on somebody else.
But also the parameters of the pilot were really within the financial space as opposed to the health sector.
Yeah.
That said, I mean, I think, again, mobile phones can be used in all sectors and can be an excellent tool for broader inclusion.
Do we have any other questions from the field?
Yes, we have a question from Amanda Lotz. She's joining from the Financial Inclusion 2020 team. She says, I'm so sorry, were there significant differences in using MFS depending on gender? Also, did this research look into the number of visually impaired individuals who received financing, microfinance or other, in order to purchase their mobile device?
No, we didn't. That's a good question, but we did not.
Okay, then she has another question. Did this survey also utilize qualitative methods to better understand motivations behind decisions?
Good question. Martin, you want to take a stab at that one? Most of it is qualitative information, but I'll let Martin. Yeah. Go ahead, Martin.
That's right, yes. I think we are looking more at the amount of qualitative material that was factored in, both in the preparation of the tools and also in the feedback that was being received. And yes, we were seeing people giving information that we would say it's a matter of choice on how they, whatever choices they make in terms of purchases of mobile phones and the choice of MFS and those kind of things.
But that's why the methodology is focused on questionnaires and interview and discussion workshops, because then that you're able to get the qualitative information out of that. So it's a mixture of both qualitative and quantitative information. So one of the things we might do, and the final thing, is tell some stories.
No, I was just saying we're going to wrap up in a few.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions from the participants here in the room? All right, I just wanted to put one more plug out. To my knowledge, we're still moving in the direction of establishing at a global level enforceable standards for new payment systems, of which mobile financial services is a part. the normal standard setting bodies, the Basel, BIS, CPS, et cetera, I guess have been somewhat preoccupied with the financial meltdown. They're getting to the point where we're starting to hear from them on issues related to new payment systems in general. But I would hope, and we certainly have very good guidance coming out from the Financial Action Task Force from FATF, represented by Treasury from a USG perspective. So I would hope that those groups would start to engage in this discussion on what types of enforceable standards are necessary to address some of the issues that we're raising here, as well as other groups such as the Alliance for Financial Inclusion, AFI, and others. I think there's plenty of opportunity for a wide range of participation in this discussion as we go forward. And with that, I thank you all for joining us. And again, we did this pilot as a way to introduce some issues, to raise some issues, in the strong hope that you all pick this up and run with it. And we hope that that happens in the very near future.
Can I just one piece of information? I just got on my email that there's going to be the UN General Assembly on the 23rd of September is holding a high-level meeting on disability and development. And as a prelude to that, there are a number of consultations that are going on with stakeholders. And currently, started yesterday, there's a consultation that's going on in terms of using ICT for persons with disabilities as a development tool. So if anybody's interested, please check it out. It is, oh dear, let's see what their webpage is. It's the obvious HTTP, www.itu, intent at action accessibility. So that's one way you can plug in some of your ideas about, you know, accessible ICT and how we can use mobiles to better ensure the empowerment of persons with disabilities.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us for the last seminar. Thank you to Aubrey and Martin and Charlotte and Maria, as well as Doug.